From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, prosecutors from red and blue states unite for a common cause.
No matter what you believe about the Second Amendment, everybody believes that people should not be victimized by gun violence.
Why a critic of sexism in video games lives in fear for her life.
I have been attacked and ultimately terrorized for 2 years.
A look inside the lives of Muhammad. And the dark and trippy world of Willy Wonka inspires the dark and trippy band Primus. That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. According to the FBI, that's the number of Americans killed in gun murders in 2012. Nearly 123,000 were robbed at gunpoint, more than 142,000 assaulted with a firearm. Next week, a group of city prosecutors from around the country will gather in Atlanta to share ideas in the battle against gun violence. I recently spoke with Cyrus Vance, the district attorney of Manhattan, and Mike Feuer, the city attorney of Los Angeles, the leaders of this new group, Prosecutors Against Gun Violence. Cyrus Vance, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Mike Feuer, welcome to you as well.
It's great to be here.
So what inspired you to begin this new group? Was there a particular incident?
No, actually, one of the goals we have is not to be reactive to a specific tragedy of the moment, but rather to get ahead of the curve. Prosecutors have a very powerful voice in the justice system, and we're very credible in the legislative process. We haven't really galvanized that focus before, but this is a chance to do it at a moment when gun violence afflicts every major jurisdiction in the country every day.
And Cyrus Vance, what specifically can prosecutors do better when it comes to gun violence?
Well, the beauty of this coalition that we've formed, which brings major city prosecutors from Seattle down to L.A., Boston to Miami, Detroit to Houston, is that we are all dealing with gun violence and its effect on our communities. And each of us has developed strategies to drive violence down. I'm fascinated to know what's going on in Houston, and I can tell you that from Manhattan's perspective, our development of units like the Crime Strategies Units that helps us work as an intelligence-based prosecution office is something that I think my colleagues will also be interested in learning about.
We're going to be learning about everything from how to combat the nexus between gangs and guns, how to deal with illegal weapons trafficking, how to do better about grappling with the connection between domestic violence and gun violence and mental health and gun violence.
I mean, that gets to what's probably about the most politically contentious issue there is. Obviously, addressing gun violence overlaps with the issue of gun control. How do you keep your efforts from getting bogged down in this very politically fraught issue?
We reflect broad geography and broad ideology. Prosecutors are not elected as Republicans or Democrats typically. We're elected on a nonpartisan basis in our jurisdictions. And I think that we'll be able to find some common ground around both our most effective prosecutorial approaches, but also on some short list of objectives policy-wise.
I think in our view as Republican and democratically elected prosecutors from all over the country, red states and blue states, I think we all on this issue don't look at gun violence as a political issue. We really are looking at it as a public health and safety issue. And no matter what you believe about the Second Amendment, everybody believes that people should not be victimized by gun violence. Now we're going to talk about how we make that happen in our various communities.
Finally, I wanted to ask, one of the most prominent incidents of gun violence this year was the police shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And that exposed, there was a real rift that exposed between law enforcement and the people of color in the community there. Do prosecutors have a role to play in healing that rift?
I can certainly say here in Los Angeles, we do. Our office is very neighborhood-oriented and very community-oriented, and we speak quite candidly about issues of youth, of race, and how we can do better at assuring there is confidence in the efficacy and the fairness of the justice system in each of our neighborhoods. Because we know that for us to be effective prosecutors, communities have to want to interact with us, have to report crime, have to team up with us as witnesses and provide the evidence we need to effectively prosecute our cases. That collaboration is very deep, and I'm very proud in Los Angeles. While we still always, in every jurisdiction, have distance to travel, we've made great strides.
Obviously, race and fairness in the justice system is an important issue in every city in America, and it certainly is in our city. And I think we invest heavily financially in our preventative programming to keep kids out of trouble, for example, in our Manhattan neighborhoods. And in doing that, we are binding the aspirations of our office with the futures of our children and their families. And that partnership is essential to have a healthy criminal justice process in any city.
Cyrus Vance is the district attorney for Manhattan. He joined us from our New York bureau. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Mike Feuer is a city attorney for Los Angeles. He was here with me at NPR West. Thank you.
Thank you, Arun.
You can carry a gun just about anywhere in Utah if you have a permit. And the state's right to carry law was back in the news this past week. Anita Sarkeesian is a feminist cultural critic. Ever since she started hosting a web series calling attention to women's portrayals in the video game industry, she's received vicious threats. Sarkeesian was scheduled to speak at Utah State University on Wednesday. The university received anonymous death threats, massacre threats, actually. That's never swayed Sarkeesian before. This time, though, she canceled the event because police said they wouldn't stop people from bringing their guns, citing the state's concealed carry laws. Anita Sarkeesian found out about the threats when she landed in Salt Lake City.
I eventually got on the phone with the police at Utah State University, and they informed me that they were going to check, not allow for backpacks and have additional security there. And when I asked them about Utah's concealed weapon laws, they informed me that they couldn't do any kind of screening for weapons, which was a little mind-boggling to me because the threat received was very reminiscent of sort of copycat killers of these, you know, misogynist massacres that had been done previously. And so they said, you know, I was like, well, can you at least, you know, have metal detectors or pat-downs? And they refused to do that. So I declined and canceled the event because I felt like that was too high of a risk to put me and the students in.
Now, this is not the first time you've been threatened. Can you talk about how you've been receiving threats recently?
Yeah, well, since I announced that I was going to be doing a video series specifically looking at the representations of women in video games, I have been attacked and ultimately terrorized for 2 years because of this series. So everything from, you know, my social media accounts flooded with misogynist and racist slurs, to trying to hack into my, you know, my social media and email.
And people can go online if they want to get a sense of this, because these threats are really, I mean, they're vile, they're specific, they're the things that we couldn't read them on the radio, couldn't even come close.
Yes. Oftentimes there are very specific rape threats, which are highly illustrative, that are also connected to, like, my home address or, you know, like, attacks on my parents and my colleagues and their families as well. And, you know, I am not the only woman being attacked right now in games. There have been a number of other women who are fearing for their lives and leaving their homes because they're receiving threats as well. So this is actually a larger problem within the gaming community right now.
So what is it with the gaming community that you know, gets to this level of nastiness and misogyny online?
Yeah, I get asked that a lot.
I am sure.
And it's a really good question that I think is pretty complicated. But, you know, one of the things is that in some ways, you know, there are some men who have gravitated towards gaming culture because they've been rejected by sort of this larger alpha male culture. But the problem with that is that gaming allows them to sort of fulfill that role of the alpha male role, right? The macho testosterone kind of posturing that you get in a lot of these sort of big AAA games. Mm-hmm. And so they're actually kind of re-perpetuating that alpha male culture by attacking people that they perceive to be weaker than them. So they're going after women, they're going after queer folks, they're going after trans folks, and especially anyone who speaks up and is critical in any way, you know, about gaming.
Can you give us a little bit of your the critique, as you've made it, of video games?
Often women are framed as helpless, or they're prizes to be won, or they're highly sexualized sort of male fantasies. The other piece of this, too, is that there's an enormous amount of violence against women that's used in these games, oftentimes just as sort of set dressing, just like in the background, these women are hurt or beaten up just to make the world seem more gritty. These representations are really harmful to women. And so, you know, we're asking for better representations and better stories, having more female protagonists that are like full and complete characters.
Anita Sarkeesian created the media criticism site Feminist Frequency. She joined us from member station KQED in San Francisco. Anita, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We also reached out to Tim Vitale. He's the executive director of PR and marketing at Utah State University. He explained the university's response.
When we got the threat, we started adding extra security measures. We were going to sweep the room for explosive devices and any other weapons and then close it. We added police officers who were going to come to the event. We were not going to allow backpacks or large packs that could carry the weaponry that the person alleged to have in the email, large caliber rifles and pipe bombs and other explosive devices. We thought we had, and we still think we had, everything in place to ensure a safe environment.
Would people have been allowed, though, to bring guns to the event?
Yes. Utah state law says that if a person has a legal concealed carry permit, they are allowed to attend public events, and we are not allowed to restrict the lawful possession or carrying of a firearm.
Anita Sarkeesian was going to be giving a speech. There have been threats, which you also considered serious. Can you understand her fear and not wanting to come to the event, knowing that people would be allowed to bring firearms there?
Absolutely. There's some debate going on now, and this is starting to get some airtime in the state. What should our state laws say? But that's a debate to be had. Maybe this will spur that debate to happen more quickly. We're certainly looking at that. This is important to us, too.
That's Tim Vitale from Utah State University. He says that local law enforcement and the FBI are still looking into the matter. Dear White People. The new film with that edgy title has Justin Simien, its young black director, being heralded as a Spike Lee for millennials. It's a movie about race and identity set at a fictional Ivy League college. Or as the poster has it, a satire about being a black face in a white place. NPR Shireen Marisol Meraji talked with the director and has more.
Dear White People follows four black students at a predominantly white college called Winchester University. Samantha White.
We can bring black back to Winchester.
She's the militant film student who heads the African-American house on campus. Coco Connors, the assimilationist who wants to fit in by any means necessary.
There is nothing hood about me.
Troy Fairbanks, the popular and handsome legacy kid, and Lionel Higgins, the film's unlikely hero, a gay sci-fi geek who has no idea where he belongs.
Tell me, man, what's harder, being black enough for the black kids or black enough for the white ones?
Being neither.
I think the film attempts to admit that there is no quintessential blackness.
Director Justin Simien says Dear White People is about the battle these four characters are having with the identities they've created and their true selves.
Each of my four characters are just attacking that same problem from a different point of view. The sort of idea, should I wear my hair this way? Should I be militant? Should I conform? I think they're all kind of struggling with the deep fear that this is all just in response to white people.
He says he's trying to get at how this battle between identity and self, a part of the universal college experience, is made more difficult when you're one of just a few black faces on a campus. Simeon graduated from Chapman University, a predominantly white private college in Southern California, and used his personal experiences to seed the script.
My suite mate, when I first moved in, this blonde, blue-eyed kid, he insisted that he was, you know, way blacker than me because he could crip walk and I couldn't.
He says it may sound insignificant, but these things happen all the time, in college and beyond. Constantly having to prove your worth and your blackness can feel oppressive over a time. Having people assume you're a thug or a good basketball player or not black enough because you're smart or don't know the latest dance. For Simeon, it's a form of racism.
You know, racism is just part of that story. It's part of the world in which, you know, the kids in my film sort of navigate. It's not Ku Klux Klan lynch mob racism. It's sort of everyone in the workplace asking why you got the job, you know, or marveling at your master of the English language. These things do affect you.
He says, Dear White People is a response to that argument that we're post-racial after electing a black president. And for proof, look no further than the protests in Ferguson sparked by a white officer shooting a black teen. But beyond all that, he says he was hungry to see himself reflected in popular culture. A black man who's not a basketball player or a rapper, but the hero who's smart and gay.
I definitely got a subversive thrill out of, you know, sneaking a gay character in the middle of a black movie that does aim for the mainstream, because it's about time.
And Justin Simeon says he thinks audiences have been ready for a film like Dear White People for a while now. Shireen Marisol Meraji, NPR News.
It may be a sad comment on human history that so many of us are familiar with the word genocide. But it wasn't always so. Not to say, sadly, that the crime is new, but the word genocide didn't exist until 1943. Lawyer Raphael Lemkin coined the word, pairing the Greek genos for race or people with the Latin sedere for killing. Lemkin spent his life campaigning to make the world acknowledge and prosecute the crime. Edith Belzberg is the director of a new documentary, Watchers of the Sky, which tells Lemkin's story.
Every day he was going to the UN and hounding people, and this was a man who didn't speak English very well. He didn't represent a country. He didn't represent an institution. He barely had a home. He barely had food. And yet he was there every day lobbying the delegates and the ambassadors to make this a crime.
Raphael Lemkin was born in Poland in 1900, and his passion for justice was evident in his youth. In his teens, he became obsessed with what was then called the Armenian Massacres, the Ottoman Empire's campaign to exterminate its Armenian population. Lemkin became fixated on the story of one Armenian man who lost his entire family in the killings and went on to assassinate one of the leaders responsible. The man was arrested and put on trial.
Lemkin read about this, and at a young age, he said to himself, why is the killing of an individual a greater crime than the killing of millions? And that really set him on his path, and he decided that he was going to be the person who would develop and create the law to stop this from happening again.
And how did he come up with the word genocide? And can you talk also about why he thought the word was important?
He believed that if he could find the right word, if he could find the word that would unite people, that would ignite people to come together to stop these crimes. He was very good at languages. He spoke about 7 languages. And he thought that there wasn't a word that described the horror of this crime. And so he set off on a path to do that.
And let's go back a little bit to, you know, prior to World War II, mm-hmm. When he was first trying to kind of proselytize this notion mm-hmm. of making the murder of millions a crime, what was the reaction that he got?
I think that people saw him as a pest, as someone who was relentless in his cause. I think that many people hoped that he would stop and go away, and then he didn't. And as much as he didn't before World War II, he was even more persistent following the war.
A short ways into the film, you have this kind of nauseating sensation where you're dealing with the earlier part of his life where he's establishing this idea of genocide, and mm-hmm. you realize that he's a Polish Jew.
Mm-hmm. 49 members of his family were killed in the Holocaust. He tried, of course, to persuade his family to leave with him in 1939. He knew what was coming, and he tried to persuade his family to go with him to America, and they said that they would be fine. And although he was thinking about these crimes before, after that he was thinking, my God, there has to be something that people will outrage people in the same way that he was outraged by this.
Can you talk about what his role was as the world went into those prosecutions after World War II around Nuremberg?
after having coined this word, he went to Nuremberg, and in Lemkin form was equally persistent at that time, and was going to Nuremberg to try and get them to use this word. Genocide was not a crime at that time, so they couldn't prosecute for genocide. But Ben Ferencz, who's in the film, who was one of the chief prosecutors during the Nuremberg trials, did use the word genocide because he was moved by Lemkin, and he believed that that word held the weight necessary to describe what was going on.
The killing of defenseless civilians during a war may be a war crime, but the same killings are part of another crime, a graver one, if you will, genocide.
So because Nuremberg, they couldn't prosecute for genocide, that left Lemkin completely heartbroken.
Because by the Nuremberg standard, it was a crime if it was taking part during war. So if you had genocide inside your own country, nobody could do anything.
Exactly. And he understood that there was a flaw in what was happening, that had Hitler not invaded Poland and had he killed all the Jews in Germany at that time, he wouldn't have been committing a crime that could have been prosecuted by Nuremberg. That's what really enraged Lemkin. He felt a leader shouldn't have to cross a border in order to be held accountable for their crimes. He felt that crimes against humanity and war crimes weren't enough. And so he continued his cause, and he then took it to the United Nations, and he continued lobbying the leaders there to make this an international crime. And he continued until his death.
This film covers really an incredible range of material, you know, the Armenian genocide in 1915, the Holocaust, Rwanda, Darfur takes up a lot of time, what's happening in Syria.
Oh, God, I don't think people are going to see this now.
Well, I will say for a two-hour film about genocide, it's very watchable. Mm. How were you able to get through all that material?
That was the biggest challenge of how to interweave all these different stories together. We had about 800 hours of footage, 5,000 stills, and that's not even including the archival material. And it was how to interweave these stories in a coherent and lyrical way that people can be taken from one story to the next and not be fatigued, but be enriched by it. Change takes time. It doesn't happen overnight, and it takes the persistence of individuals over time until we can see the results.
Edith Belzberg is the director of the documentary Watchers of the Sky. Edith, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Across the country, cattle prices continue to rise. Drought in states like Texas and Oklahoma drove up the price of feed, forcing ranchers to sell off their cattle stock. This fall, feed prices dropped, and now ranchers are looking to replenish their dwindling herds. Low supply and high demand are making for some very valuable cows. In Oklahoma, Tulsa Stockyards reported selling 4,500 head of cattle at record prices in a single day's sale this month. Record prices mean ranchers have to be extra vigilant with their herds. Just ask Leon Langford. He runs a cattle ranch an hour south of Tulsa.
Our family's been in this business for 75 years. Just general taking care of cattle all day, every day.
The Langfords have 1,000 head of cattle on their ranch. But recently, 19 registered purebred Herefords worth $100,000 suddenly disappeared. They were stolen. Like something out of an old Western, cattle rustlers, thieves, stealing cattle in the dead of night.
You know you're sick at your stomach because you lost them, but when you know they're stolen, it's even a little worse. Somebody takes things that don't belong to them, it's a sickening feeling.
Since the cattle were branded, law enforcement was able to identify some of the animals.
Nobody else in Texas, New Mexico, or Oklahoma's got that same brand, and we know when we see that brand, it's our cattle.
The woman selling them at an auction in southern Oklahoma has since been sentenced to 2 years in jail.
We're happy to get some of them back, and we got a little over half of them back. I mean, all the cattle were real valuable.
When cattle go missing, the Texas and Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association is on the case. You can find Special Ranger Wayne Goodman keeping an eye on local sale barns in Texas. With his badge, cowboy hat, and pistol, I guess you could call him the sheriff of cattle country. Goodman's job is to track down rustlers, and his work keeps him busy.
I've got one I started yesterday where 50 calves were taken.
He says thieves will drive out to pasture and get a lay of the land. When it's time to strike,
come in at night, they will honk the horn, call the cows up, and they'll pull in there with a trailer and load them up and they're gone.
For some ranchers, it could be days before they realize the herd has shrunk. That gives rustlers plenty of time to transport cattle out of state, never to be seen again.
They usually take them to auction, kind of like if I break into your house and steal a TV set or your stereo, or I can take it to a pawn shop and I get 10 cents on a dollar, maybe if I'm lucky. I can take your cows to an auction barn and I get dollar for dollar.
It's a lucrative enterprise for the cattle rustler. For the rancher, it's devastating.
These ranchers have a lot of money and a lot of time in these animals. Some guys could lose two or three and it would hurt them real bad, because a lot of these cattle are mortgaged through banks. I worked a case out in East Texas when I was stationed out there, where I've got two families had to sell their homes because of loss of cattle.
It seems like it'd be impossible to track down stolen animals, but Goodman says it comes down to the tried and true method of identification.
Now, branding is the oldest form of identifying cattle, but it's still the most effective.
He says in Texas, ranchers register their unique brand symbols.
You have to put down what your brand is, draw a picture of it, and where are you going to put it on the animal? Left hip, right shoulder, left shoulder, all of that is part of your brand registration.
They also keep track of ear tags and even small tattoos inside the animal's ears. It all goes into the Texas and Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association database. So when a critter goes missing, special rangers know exactly what markings to look for at the local auction.
We've had cases where we knew the cattle were stolen before the owner did.
The risk involved still doesn't stop the thieves.
There's all kinds of reasons for it. I mean, there have been instances where one young man was doing it to pay his girlfriend's rent. It's all about the money.
And in this market, there's a lot of money to go around. For Special Ranger Wayne Goodman, he just hopes the money ends up in the right hands. News about drought only seems to get scarier, and we're seeing that reflected in a bunch of new movies and books pairing droughts with dystopias. Unsurprisingly, says NPR's Netta Ulaby, many of these seem to be aimed towards young adults.
A futuristic Western opening this weekend takes place in a sun-bleached, dried-out desert that used to be worked by farmers.
I never saw this land when it was green. My father did. He worked it before the drought came. He used to talk about it all the time. Even as the fights over water first divided states, then towns, and then neighbors.
The movie, Young Ones, was directed and written by Jake Paltrow, Gwyneth's little brother. Paltrow was inspired in part by the semi-rural, working-class aesthetic of S.E. Hinton's young adult novels, but also from dystopian stories that aren't fictional at all, like how lack of waters intensified conflict in Somalia, Israel, Palestine, and America's own Dust Bowl history.
You know, in our film, they're washing dishes with sand. They're getting into shootouts over, you know, wells that have almost no water left in them.
We might be running low on water, but not stories about a frightening future without it, especially with young adult titles like The Water Wars and Drought. In a drought dystopia called Not a Drop to Drink, a teenage girl and her mother live in a crumbling farmhouse with a pond after climate change has ruined the world's water supply. Stephanie Myers, who wrote the Twilight series, optioned it for her Hollywood production company. Not a Drop to Drink was inspired by a documentary about a terrifying future of spreading deserts, depleted wells, corporatization of water, and death through dehydration.
The tongue swells so large that it squeezes past the jaws. The eyelids crack, and the eyeballs begin to weep tears of blood.
The documentary, Blue Gold, made author Mindy McGinnis grateful to live in a rural farmhouse with a pond.
The night after I watched the documentary, I actually dreamt that I was having to defend my pond violently in order to survive.
In a reading from the book, the heroine has to fend off strangers trying to steal her water and the threat of cholera.
With dead bodies dropping all around the countryside and the water tables rising from spring rains, Mother had decided the pond water could kill them as easily as save them.
They purify it with a real process using the sun as disinfectant.
Sheets of tin roofing from the old red barn were laid out in the yard, the ends weighed with rocks to prevent them from blowing away. They could only purify on clear days when a full 8 hours of UV rays would kill any bacteria in the water.
Author Mindy McGinnis jokes that her research was, sorry, pretty dry. But she did plenty, as did Annie Itaranta. She wrote another drought-themed dystopian novel called The Memory of Water that came out last spring.
I tried to think of what places in the world would still have fresh water available if there was a serious shortage of it.
Her answer? Finland, where she's from. Itaranta researched all kinds of questions while writing her book.
Where would food come from if there was very little water available? What kind of crops would we be able to grow? What kind of animals would survive? There are actually no animals in the book.
Itaranta says she hopes the popularity of dystopian young adult fiction could be a way to interest readers more in environmental issues. Heather Hauser, a University of Texas professor who studies literature and the environment, says these stories tend to share DNA with American frontier literature.
There is so much focus on the home and the homestead. It makes it a question of survival, protecting private property,
and not displacing our anxieties onto metaphors. Hauser says we like to do that with zombies or vampires. With droughts and climate change, we seem okay with being literal.
Thinking about the monstrous as being meteorological or climatological, maybe that makes a lot of sense.
And maybe with droughts, Hauser says, we understand that our real worst enemies are ourselves. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
Muhammad is, without a doubt, one of the most important men in human history. But when it comes to Muhammad's own life, there's not too much we can say with historical certainty. The details of his life have been debated and manipulated since the birth of Islam in the 7th century. Keisha Ali's new book, The Lives of Muhammad, examines the different ways his life story has been told, from the earliest days of Islam to the present.
Non-Muslims have been writing about Muhammad almost as long as Muslims have, and the things that they had to say about him were very much shaped by what knowledge they did have, much of it inaccurate, but also by current theological, political, social worries, so that when paganism was the concern, Muhammad was a pagan or idol or a god. When heresy was a concern, Muhammad was akin to a Christian heretic. Hmm. When fraud and imposters were the concern, Muhammad was a fraud. He was the arch imposter. Over the centuries, European Christian accounts of Muhammad in particular went through a variety of stages and depictions. What begins to happen in the modern era is that European researchers begin to look at Muslim historical chronicles and sources and to merge their scholarly interests with their interest in Christian evangelism. And those depictions, which claim to be historically accurate and based on early Muslim sources, then engender a reaction from Muslim biographers.
In the Islamic world, one of the most intense debates seems to be about whether Muhammad was divine or divinely inspired or a man, just like any other man. Can you talk about what's at stake in that debate and if one particular view has prevailed?
Well, I certainly think the view that has prevailed among Muslims has always been that Muhammad is a man. But the Muslim response to the traditional saying that Muhammad is a man is, yes, but like a ruby among stones, which is to say Muhammad is a man, but he's a very unusual sort of man. He's not divine, but he has the divine in him in the sense that he is divinely inspired. His character is luminous. His ability to intercede on behalf of Muslims has historically been a very important part of his persona. He is the beloved of God. The way in which he surpasses humanity has historically been very, very important. I would say it's been downplayed somewhat in some modern Muslim biographies, but that tension has always been present.
And it's interesting how that fits in with, as you note, some of the more ecumenical-minded Western thinkers who would put Muhammad in with that idea of genius, natural genius.
Absolutely. And it's so striking to see the ways in which we move from Muhammad the imposter to Mohammed the genius, where you're unveiling what's real underneath. And of course, this is in keeping with trends in the West to thinking in a different way about the presence of the divine, where it's not revelation from on high, but something innate in the core of the human being, or at least certain human beings.
But what about what we might term more reactionary groups, some modern groups, say like ISIS? How does their version of Muhammad's life diverge from what we might call the mainstream view?
So they're making interpretive choices too. They are saying we're going to focus on a particular and not a particularly well-supported version of a political program of establishing God's rule. We're going to focus on particular norms that we want to see implemented. But it's actually been very striking to me how little direct appeal there is to the kind of interpretive tradition that looks at translating Muhammad's life and Muhammad's example and Muhammad's precedent into rules for Muslims of later generations to follow. Because, of course, that has been a major concern of Muslim jurists for well over 1,000 years.
All that's disputed about the actual life of Muhammad, it seems that the Quran is really the closest source to the man in terms of text that we have. And isn't the Quran supposed to be, you know, really the thing anyway? What's it, you know, how important is the biography?
So that's a hugely complicated question, actually. Isn't the Quran supposed to be the thing? And the reality is that, of course, the Quran is the thing, but the idea that it can be separated out from the life of Muhammad makes no sense for the vast majority of Muslims. Mm. I have a colleague who likes to say, Muhammad wasn't just a UPS delivery guy. He didn't just bring this book and say, here you go, good luck. And for the vast majority of Muslim history, people have really interpreted the one by means of the other. And the other thing, of course, is that most Muslims didn't have access to printed copies of the Quran or online copies that they could keyword search. You had to get this from somewhere, just like most Christians didn't have copies of the Bible until relatively recently. And so that process of looking at the text has almost always taken place through the lens of looking at the life of the prophet. Now, was it the historical events of the life of the prophet, or was it something about his luminous character that was revealed in the things that we know about his life, but also things passed down through, in some cases, a charismatic lineage of mystical teachers? There are a lot of ways in which Muhammad's life has been understood and experienced and celebrated in the past 1,400 years, and not all of them are captured by biography, to be sure.
That's Keisha Ali. Her new book is called The Lives of Muhammad, and it's out now. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You may have heard of the Hollywood lion, the mountain lion that lives in Griffith Park, right here in the city of Los Angeles. The big cat, known as P-22 to ecologists, somehow made it across two very busy freeways to get there. Mountain lions like solitude, but if P-22 wants to find a mate and have some cubs, he'll have to risk his life again in L.A. traffic. And P-22's dilemma is faced by an entire population of mountain lions just a little ways up the freeway. I'm walking along the 101 freeway with Seth Riley, wildlife ecologist for the National Park Service. The freeway slices right across the wilderness in this stretch along the Santa Monica Mountains.
No one in 1950 was thinking about getting wildlife across the roads when the freeway was built. And so not only do you have the freeway, but you have intense development all along it. It's basically a big development corridor.
That isolated the mountain lion population here, trapping them between the freeway and the ocean. That's led to severe inbreeding, which could mean the end of the group. Riley says a similar situation threatened the Florida panther, also surrounded by encroaching human development.
They got down to under 30 animals, and they had even lower genetic diversity than we're seeing here. So they had holes in the heart, this atrial septa. They had males where one or both testes didn't descend, and if both didn't descend, they were sterile, basically, and they had major reproductive problems. They had disease issues.
Riley and his colleagues want the lions here in the Santa Monica Mountains to avoid that fate. They track a number of GPS-tagged mountain lions on both sides of the freeway to monitor the populations. When a male lion from the north, this one named P12, crossed the freeway to join the isolated Santa Monica cats, the ecologists felt like popping the champagne.
He came from the north, and he had a lot of genetic material that was new to the Santa Monica Mountains. Now, if he had crossed and not survived, it wouldn't have done any good. But fortunately, not only did he survive, but he then became a dominant breeding male in the Santa Monica Mountains and had many offspring and continues to have offspring, actually.
But unfortunately, just one new cat can't fix the inbreeding problem, as P12 eventually proved to Riley and his colleagues.
So that's the good news, although a little bit of the bad news is he has also mated probably repeatedly, definitely at least once, with his daughter. And they probably don't know, he probably doesn't know it's his daughter, he's just mating with whatever females he can find. The males don't participate in the taking care of the offspring at all. But that kind of very close inbreeding between fathers and daughters is not good for the genetic diversity.
Walking along the freeway here, it's easy to see why more lions don't make the crossing. It's actually kind of amazing that P12 made it across. It's not just the freeway. There are structures, walls, fencing on both sides. It's just about impossible for us to get through.
All right. That wasn't too bad, right?
Sadly, other lions have tried, but weren't as lucky as P12. One met his end right along this stretch of road.
What may have happened, again, you know, we don't know for sure, but is that he got across the freeway, ran into this wall, and couldn't keep going, and then got confused or tried to go back and end up getting hit by a car.
Ecologists in Florida solved their inbreeding problem by transplanting cats from distant populations. But ecologists here think there's a simpler, natural solution with a population of cats literally right across the street.
Our real hope is to have an overpass across 101 here. It would connect that ridge coming down on the north side and then come down on the south side to natural area, which is the critical thing.
A wildlife overpass. They've been built successfully in Montana, Canada, and the Netherlands. They're quite wide and planted with grass and trees and other vegetation. Barbara Marquez is senior environmental planner for the California Department of Transportation.
You know, from the side view as a motorist going down the 101, it might not look very different from a regular bridge of the same type of size, except for the fact that there would be vegetation growing on it.
From the air, it would look like a patch of wilderness we're crossing the freeway, just as the freeway crosses the wilderness everywhere else. Marquez says the overpass wouldn't just be for lions. The plant cover will benefit a lot of species that want to cross, including the two-legged variety.
So this wildlife overcrossing would connect the trail from one side to the other, so pedestrians would be allowed to use it as well. And it would definitely be innovative because there's nothing like that here in California.
Marquez declined to put a price tag on the overpass because it's still in the planning stages. The cost depends a lot on the size and scope. Wildlife overpasses in Canada have cost just a few million dollars, though some in the U.S. are projected to cost much more. But Seth Riley thinks that the overpass would have benefits that can't be measured in dollars.
It's expensive and it's going to take some time, but I think it would be an amazing statement about wildlife and conservation in the second largest metropolitan area in the country and one of the largest in the world to put a crossing, especially an overpass that everyone would see. You know, everyone that would drive that freeway would see, wow. They put something over this freeway specifically for wildlife.
Despite public and political support, the National Park Service and the state's transportation agencies have spent more than a decade trying to fund the project. And right now, funding for infrastructure is tight. The federal government recently denied an application for a $2 million transportation grant to pay for part of the overpass. But ecologists and conservation activists aren't giving up. They're working with local agencies and trying to raise support and money from the private sector.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination.
Gene Wilder as Willy Wonka. Any kid who saw that 1971 film fell in love with Wonka's world, even though it could be disturbing. Some of us fell in love with it because it was so disturbing. One kid in particular was so smitten that he carried those songs with him throughout his own almost three-decade recording career.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, the Chocolate Room.
Les Claypool leads the avant-garde funk band Primus, a supremely weird band. We dare you to play this on the radio, weird. And somehow, in the 90s, they were all over radio. So for a band that wears its weirdness quite proudly, this should come as no shock. For their new album, they've adapted just about every song from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory into the style of Primus. I spoke with Les Claypool about the first time he saw the film in theaters.
I was a young fellow. I was in grammar school, and it was the perfect thing for a kid my age. And I went on to collect all the box tops off of Captain Crunch or whatever it was so that I could get my Willy Wonka chocolate factory kit where you melt down chocolate chips into these little molds that shape like Oompa Loompas and wrap them in foil and then hand them out to the kids at school. I did the whole routine.
I remember seeing that as a kid and thinking that, wow, that's amazing they're letting me watch this. Something kind of slipped past the grown-ups. This is messed up.
Well, when the centipede crawls across the guy's face, that's pretty creepy. You know, but the thing is watching the film, then that introduced me to that world. And I had to start reading Roald Dahl. And I read the two Chocolate Factory books. And they're pretty dark and sinister and creepy, especially the Great Glass Elevator. So, you know, for me, us taking on this project wasn't so much, hey, we're going to go and do, you know, our interpretation of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory as much as it was my interpretation of my interpretation as a kid of that world.
Who can take a sunrise? Sprinkle it in dew.
When did you decide that you wanted to do your own take on this?
Well, there was a thought. I'd always had that Candyman, my take on Candyman, in my head. I'd had that for a while. And we were talking about the next project to do. We were talking about taking on some form of sacred cow. So every New Year's, we have a themed New Year's event. And so this last year, we said, well, let's do Primus and the Chocolate Factory, and we'll do a couple of the songs from the film, and then a couple songs turned into more than a couple songs.
There's no earthly way of knowing which direction you're going.
Were any of these songs particularly difficult to arrange for the band, or were they all something where you could find that kind of demented quality that you can pull out of them?
What are you trying to say? You know, to be honest with you, it all fell together surprisingly easy. The hardest thing I had was doing the vocal on Golden Ticket, because I would do it and then I would keep thinking I sound like a guy trying to be an old man singing this song. And then I sort of stumbled across this this character of being like an elderly Elvis impersonator, and that's kind of how I approached it from that point. And then it just clicked and away I went.
I'm speaking with Les Claypool of Primus. Their new album is Primus and the Chocolate Factory. Let me throw a Wonka quote at you. A little nonsense now and then is relished by the wisest men. And that's something that definitely makes me think of Primus, that you guys have serious chops as musicians, but whimsy's never too far away.
Yes, and it's been a source of joy and a source of criticism over the years at times. You know, I think I went through a period there where I became a bit self-conscious of it. Because I remember in the early days, people would ask me in interviews, oh, don't you ever worry about being taken seriously? And I would say, no, you know, I wouldn't worry about that at all. Until some people started not necessarily taking it seriously. And then, you know, after we did the Big Brown Beaver song, all of a sudden there was a contingent of folks out there that just thought we were a joke band.
My mom's got herself a Big Brown Beaver and she shows them off to all her friends. One day you know that beaver tried to leave it, so she gave him up a cyclone.
So you become a little self-conscious of it. You read a few reviews, and that stuff can affect you. It's like watching, you know, some of your favorite comedians over the years start taking on serious roles and losing that jolly edge or the edge that got them to the place where they were. And I think we kind of went through a little bit of that.
You think this is bringing you back to the jolly?
I think in just in general, over the past 10 years, I haven't really given a about any of that. So, you know, I grew up with stuff like Willy Wonka and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and some of these Disney musicals, early Disney musicals. And, you know, it made me write from the perspective of a lot of these characters, you know, being a big fan of Frank Capra and Aaliyah Kazan and Terry Gilliam and seeing these films with these extremely colorful, poignant characters. That's how I always tried to convey whatever the hell it was I was trying to say in the music. And even though a lot of times, just like on this Wonka recording, these characters can be sinister and tragic, you know, there's a lighthearted element to them or a colorful element.
I've heard you talk about being inspired by Gene Wilder. Have you ever met him?
I never have, no.
Do you know if he knows about this record?
I doubt that he does.
Because apparently when the 2005 remake came out, he was pretty offended by that. He called it an insult.
I heard about that as well. And there's a good possibility there's going to be some folks insulted by this as well. You know, I think that's the folly of taking on a sacred cow. You know, you're going to please some folks and you're going to piss off some folks. But I hope I don't piss off Gene Wilder, because he's definitely for his 70s hairdo alone, he is a champion.
That's Les Claypool, founding member of the band Primus. Their new album is called Primus in the Chocolate Factory. It won't come out until Tuesday. The suspense is terrible, Les. I hope it'll last.
Yeah.
You get the line.
Good quote.
Les Claypool.
I like it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, no worries. Good talking to you.
Likewise. For the week ending October 19th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, Becky Sullivan, Denise Guerra, and Eliza Mills. Our intern is Chloe Prisinos. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Leo Dell'Aquila and Marcia Caldwell. Muthoni Muturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.